Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's episode of Big Ten Hoops Weekly. I'm Brett, and I am here, as always, with my good friend Steve. Steve, how are you doing this fine afternoon?
Well, I've got all my Final Four teams left, although the rest of my bracket doesn't look great, but I guess that means I'm doing fine.
You're doing better than me, my friend. Baylor did not really help me out yesterday, but that's a conversation for another day, because we have a lot of Big Ten basketball to talk about. It was a really exciting weekend overall, a little maybe chalkier perhaps than you would have expected, given that I believe all of the 1 and 2 seeds are still alive in the NCAA, in the men's tournament. But that doesn't mean there's not a lot to talk about. I think we saw a lot of very interesting things this week, especially from a Big Ten perspective and across the board. But for all intents and purposes, it's best to get into it with the teams that are still alive. And we will start with the Illinois Fighting Illini, who let Morehead State hang around for more than I think a lot of people anticipated. I believe Illinois was only up 1 at halftime and then pulled away kind of early in the second half against Morehead State, and then ended up winning by 16, if my math is correct. That game was kind of everything from an offensive standpoint that we are used to from the Illini, and also kind of from a defensive standpoint. You know, 1.33 points per possession for the Illini on offense. They surrendered over 1 point per possession to a team outside the top 100 in offense, gave up a lot of threes, but were able to kind of control things in transition. And then Illinois was able to just absolutely destroy a Duquesne team that, you know, I don't know that anybody really expected Duquesne to show up in the second round, but Illinois made relatively much quicker work of them by jumping out to a 27-11 lead and cruising from there. 1.4 points per possession, but still over 1 point per possession allowed on defense. So obviously, you know, you can only play the teams that are put in front of you. I think that's, you know, that's how the tournament works. And their offensive numbers are still absolutely eye-popping. But are you seeing anything that's kind of, so, you know, I guess obviously the offense has been good, but are you seeing anything that's maybe at least something to keep an eye on as they head into the Sweet 16 in a much tougher matchup that we're going to discuss in the preview part of this podcast?
I'm going to go with no as the short answer. Like, look, I think a lot of the rhetoric around fighting off demons in this conference was centered around Purdue, but Illinois had some demons that they needed to fight off too, right? And, you know, they haven't had the tournament success under Brad Underwood that their fan base has wanted them to have. And this weekend, they just put their foot down and said, we are done dealing with this and we are going to, you know, get ourselves to the Sweet 16. And so I think there was a lot of good that, you know, we talked about with Illinois that, you know, you didn't even hit on in your opening remarks. I think, you know, it was great to see Dane Danger have a great first game against Morehead State, where he had 21 points, I believe. You know, he probably was licking his chops at the opportunity to not have to face the typical size that he faces in the Big Ten. And I think, like, look, we should call it like it is. Like, this was a close game, you know, with Morehead for the first, call it, 30 minutes. And then, you know, Illinois sort of turned it on and ran away with it. Now, that's not to say that, like they've kind of been doing that with teams up to this point, but you know, there were clearly some nerves there and jitters at the beginning that they had to get out, and, you know, good on them for getting those out. But, you know, the other thing that I think you just have to mention when you mention this Illinois team, it's a lot of what we've been talking about before. I mean, Terrence Shannon scored 26 points in the first game against Morehead State, another 30 against Duquesne. Damask had the triple double in his first game, and then poured in 22 points on 16 shots against Duquesne. I mean, they're riding their guys that have got them there. They're operating very efficiently, but, like, in some ways, this is just a continuation of what we've seen with them. I think this is slightly inferior offensive competition compared to some of the teams they played in the Big Ten tournament. They look incredibly consistent on offense, and, you know, they're going to need that as they go forth from here.
Yeah, no, and I didn't mean to be overly critical. I just think that, you know, a game against two lesser tier teams is not necessarily the best measuring stick. But again, you can only play who they put in front of you. But I think another positive was that, you know, Duquesne had a high scoring guard, Day-Day Grant, and they were really able to shut him down, hold him to 7 points on 2 of 9 from the field, which is impressive given kind of how we've talked about Illinois' defense. But I also think that, you know, as part of this great coaching job that Brad Underwood has done, he's really kind of learned from how the season has progressed. I think, you know, there was a time where Dane Dangel was basically out of the rotation except for some spot minutes here and there. And he's been extremely efficient in the minutes he's been playing, as you mentioned. So it's good to see Underwood kind of adapting at a time in the season where coaches are less likely to be flexible and more likely to be rigid in how they're giving out minutes and utilizing their rotations. Anything else on Illinois before we head on?
I don't know that there's that much to say. I mean, like, look, at the end of the day, every game from here is a coin flip. You could argue that even that Duquesne one was going to be a coin flip going into that. I think it's great to see that they're peaking at the right time. They need, you know, Underwood needs to get more March wins under his belt for the sake of his job security. Like you mentioned, we'll talk about their matchup against Iowa State in a little bit here, but Illinois has been trending up, you know, I think for a number of weeks here, and I'm glad we saw it play out.
Yeah, absolutely. So congrats to the Illini for their Sweet 16. First Sweet 16 in quite some time. And, you know, Steve, you had mentioned shaking off demons last year, and there's no better team to talk about that than the Purdue Boilermakers, the second and final team still alive in the NCAA tournament for the Big Ten. The whole season, I think, for Purdue was not about would they win another Big Ten, would they win another Big Ten tournament, but it's what do they look like when they take the floor for that first game in the NCAA tournament. And they answered that question pretty emphatically with damn good. They've scored over 180 points in their first two games combined. They're playing really good defense, again, against, you know, some teams from some smaller conferences, but I think they're sticking with what got them, you know, to this lofty number one ranking. They were, you know, 1.28 points per possession against a just totally overmatched Grambling State team that they didn't let kind of the smaller guard lineups that like with Fairleigh Dickinson last year really bother Edie. Edie had 30 points on 11 of 17 from the field. He had 21 rebounds, and you could just tell that this team was really locked in and ready to go. Despite, you know, a bit of an off shooting night from Braden Smith, they were still, you know, able to just pull away early. I mean, they were, yeah, just that, not really much to talk about there. And then they faced a Utah State team with, again, a little bit of an undersized guard rotation. So a team that was really going to focus on packing the paint, making anyone besides Edie beat them. And they had a you know, they've got a good big man in Great Osabor, but again, Purdue scored 106 points. They won the game by almost 40. It was just truly never in doubt. Even I think Utah State led 7 minutes into the game, and that was it. They were up by four, and then Purdue just really took control. Four guys in double figures, 1.43 points per possession against, you know, a top 100 defense is impressive to say the least. And holding them under a point per possession too. So I mean, we're seeing the Boilermakers locked in and ready to go. What are your thoughts on how they handled this weekend?
I mean, I don't think we need to like complicate this. They looked the part, right? I mean, the story about, you know, would they avoid another 116 upset, you know, a little bit overblown, right? Like just statistically, it was an anomaly that they lost last year, and they needed to just show up in a little bit more to take care of Grambling State. You know, and they did that emphatically with, you know, Edie, pounding Edie. You know, he had 30 and 21, which I feel like, you know, when someone puts that up in a tournament game, you're in amazement, but we're just so used to those types of games from Edie that it's just like, oh yeah, you know, another day for him. I was more impressed with how they came out against Utah State. And, you know, I think the Mountain West as a conference, you know, I think maybe we're seeing that the hype around that conference was, you know, a little bit overblown after, you know, their performance in the first 4 days here. But I mean, they just put their foots on Utah State's neck and, you know, did not let them see the light of day. I mean, I think the biggest story to talk about in this game is the fact that they didn't really need a lot of minutes out of their key guys to, you know, to get this one done. It was academic, you know, for most of the second half. And, you know, they come in well-rested, guns blazing, and, you know, cruising into the Sweet 16, which is what, you know, national title contenders are supposed to do.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just want to add, we're seeing even more guys step up for Purdue. You know, we know obviously their main complementary players are Kaufman Wren and Gillis, but they're getting a lot of production out of Cam Heidi and even a bit from Miles Colvin, who you know, each 10 and 9 points respectively, shooting well from three against Utah State team that, again, no slouch defensively. So that that just says all good things about where Purdue's headed. And, you know, obviously Edie with another 23-14 performance, just really staying the course and consistent domination. And obviously, like you said, you know, from here on out, games against better competition can often just end up being coin flips. But I'd say Purdue's positioned themselves as well as anybody in that's remaining in the Sweet 16. So excited to see what they do from here. Now we are going to do the in memoriam section of our tournament recap, talk about the teams that went down fighting. And we'll start with the, I believe the teams that each got one win. So we'll start with the Michigan State Spartans, who were really kind of in control the entire game against a Mississippi State team that was playing hard, but kind of, as we noted last week, didn't really have the skills to match up with the guard play of Michigan State. You know, Tyson Walker had 19, Jaden Akins had 15, and Malik Hall was also in double figures for the Spartans, despite they shot 43% from three. So despite a lot of turnovers, they were able to get the shot making they need and hold Mississippi State way under a point per possession. So they were actually getting it done at both ends. And so, you know, I think those 8-9 games are always kind of up in the air. So they were able to really kind of take control relatively early and hold off Mississippi State from there. And then they put up a pretty solid fight for most of the game against North Carolina, the one seed, actually leading by as much as 12 in the first half before North Carolina's talent advantage really played out. And we saw that, I think, especially with some of the interior presence. I mean, Armando Bacot had 18, and I believe that's 7 rebounds. Harrison Ingram was kind of a matchup nightmare all night. He hit 5 threes. RJ Davis hit 3 threes, and the Tar Heels just showed that they're the more complete team this year. But, you know, I think it was overall an impressive showing from Michigan State. I mean, you know, I think their preseason expectations relative to how they performed were not where we thought they were going to be. We didn't think they'd enter the tournament as an 8 seed, but I think they acquitted themselves about as well as they could have against a team with significantly more talent in North Carolina.
Yeah, I mean, I was really impressed with how Michigan State looked in their game against Mississippi State. Like, Mississippi State is not an easy team to play in any environment, right? Like, they make it really, really tough on you when they're on defense. And they've got guys that can get out and run, they can make threes, you know, when they want to. And you know, what I saw out of Michigan State in this game was that they did not allow Mississippi State to get the amount of offensive rebounds that they typically need to win these types of games. You know, and it's funny because I say that with Mississippi State having, you know, they got 13 of them, but Michigan State was actually able to win the rebounding battle overall and overcome 16 turnovers, you know, to get this win. They looked in control. They looked like, you know, your regular Tom Izzo team when they head into their first game of March Madness that we're used to seeing historically out of that program. I was not expecting that given how inconsistent this team's been, especially, you know, down the stretch of play here. And, you know, it kind of carried over to at least the first half of that UNC game. Now, you know, when your third best player, AJ Hoggard, only scores 3 points, you know, you're only going to be able to go so far. And, you know, we talked about it with this team all year. It's their big men that held them back. They did a good enough job defensively to get them the win over Mississippi State. But I think the ceiling on this team was capped from the beginning, which, you know, I know relative to, you know, where this team was ranked in the preseason, I think, you know, that's the biggest surprise with this team for the whole year, that like they just got absolutely nothing out of their big guys. But I think, yeah, given, you know, the reset expectations for them, I think it was really great for them to win a game in this tournament. But they were not going to have more than a puncher's chance against the, you know, this UNC team.
Yeah. So I think we can agree that they emerged cavity free from the dentist, but didn't quite make it out of the second round. All right. So the final team that got a win for the Big Ten in the round of 64 was the Northwestern Wildcats, who had a pretty wild game against Florida Atlantic that ended up in overtime and just really took control in overtime. Winning by 12 in overtime is pretty nuts. Scoring 19 points in overtime is as well. And it was a relatively inefficient game for Boo Booey. I believe 8 for 20 from the field, including 4 of 10 from 3. But, you know, the complimentary scoring is, as we've talked about all season, is what really kind of picked them up. Ryan Langborg had 27 points. Brooks Barnheiser added 13, and they got enough out of the rebounding game to really weather the storm. I thought they did a pretty good job on Vlad Goldin by not letting him really take over the game. And Elijah Martin was basically a non-factor, and so Janelle Davis, they were kind of able to make him have a really inefficient game as well. Florida Atlantic was at 0.84 points per possession, which for the number 22 offense in the country is a really impressive job by Chris Collins's crew, especially, you know, as we've talked about without Ty Berry, without Matt Nicholson. This was just a game that we had talked about. Bowie and crew are going to have to will themselves to this win. And they really did, despite a strong Owls comeback kind of down the stretch in the second half. So, you know, in overtime, they were able to kind of impose their will and really get things done. So kudos to them. Kudos to Chris Collins. I mean, again, Northwestern's not an easy place to win, and he's gotten them to the second round of the tournament, you know, gotten a couple tournament wins under his belt. And I think that's, you know, that's a huge, huge kudos to him for that. And then they ran into the buzzsaw that is the UConn Huskies. And honestly, like, holding them to 75 points in a 65-possession game is pretty solid. You know, Tristan Newton is one of the best guards in the country, and they have elite shooting to surround Donovan Klingon. So they were able to keep Klingon from dominating the scoring, but he did have 14 rebounds. And even though Northwestern did a good job on the defensive glass, there's just too much talent, I would say, from the perspective of keeping up with a team like UConn. The disparity was a little too big for Northwestern to overcome.
Yeah, my game ball for this weekend for the Wildcats goes to Ryan Langborg. I mean, he was the guy that, you know, made the big shots down the stretch for them against Florida Atlantic and sort of hit the shots to get them up early in overtime that allowed them to sort of cruise to win. Yeah, and I mean, like you talked about, I mean, a lot of the credit here, I think, goes to Chris Collins. I mean, they're just, you know, they've turned themselves into just one of the most dependable teams in the country when it comes to how tough of defense they play. They're well-schooled fundamentally. You know, they forced 21 turnovers on Florida Atlantic. It was really sort of a messy game plan, you know, from the Owls' perspective there. And yeah, you know, winning in March is not easy. You know, the next step for this program is, you know, going to be how to crack the Sweet 16. But I think if you're Northwestern and you look back at the season, it to me, the sad part is more about what could have been if Ty Berry and Matt Nicholson were healthy. I know on this seed line, it was going to be hard for them to get any farther really than they did. But, you know, had those guys been healthy, maybe they'd be up 2 to 3 lines and, you know, had a more realistic shot at the Sweet 16. But overall, great season for Northwestern. And great tournament performance, especially given their draw.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. I know it's kind of hard to give those kinds of kudos when the season ends like that, but I totally echo everything you said. All right, so we have two more teams, both that dropped their first round games. We will start with the Nebraska Cornhuskers, who, you know, this was always going to be an interesting game. I don't think that we quite expected Texas A&M, who even now after this performance is 342nd in the country in threes at 29%, to go 13 of 23 from three, led by 7 from Wade Taylor, who, you know, we had a lot of really good things to say about Wade Taylor. Didn't think that going 70% from three was on my bingo board. But I, you know, we had talked about kind of the issue with offensive rebounding, and A&M was able to corral 14 offensive rebounds. That's 40% of their misses to just 7 for Nebraska. So, you know, we talked about the importance of Nebraska's big lineup really being able to needing to rebound against a pretty ferocious A&M rebounding attack. And, you know, they did lead the country in offensive rebounds on a percentage basis, and Nebraska just couldn't keep them off the boards. And they were able to generate a good amount of second chance points, and that led to 1.32 points per possession for, you know, a efficient if unspectacular offense. But I think the story of the day was, you know, the 3-point shooting of Texas A&M was not equaled by Nebraska, which finished 7 for 22 despite 5 made threes for Keisei Tominaga, and the Huskers did bow out, losing by 15. But 3-point variance aside, you know, I don't think anyone has any really negative thoughts about Nebraska this year, given kind of where they were the last couple of years and how Hoiberg's put this team together and the resilience they've shown year over year. So I get that it really stings to win, to go out of the tournament that way, but I don't think that Huskers fans should be hanging their heads at all.
Yeah. And I mean, like, look, this is part of the learning process that a team has to go through. I mean, more than like a program has to go through when they're trying to graduate from, you know, being an upstart that, you know, kind of caught people by surprise, which I think was the case, you know, even going back to the second half of last year, you know, and for a lot of this year, frankly, to, you know, actually being ready and prepared to expect what the tournament environment is like and going out there and winning. And like, look, you know, you're 100% right. Sometimes you get wacky outcomes in these tournament games where like a team that's terrible at threes all of a sudden shoots the lights out. They run away, hide. And like, you know, if you're not on that day, you're just not going to come back. This was more that than I think it was any sort of indictment about like, you know, how Nebraska was coached or the preparation or anything. Like, I don't think this is an indictment on anything there. I think it still stinks that this team hasn't won a tournament game, but I think the future is bright under Fred Hoiberg. Seemed like something was off from the get-go in this game, and I think it's disappointing because I think Nebraska did have of any of the 8 seeds, you know, they probably had the best draw and the best shot at getting to the Sweet 16 at least. So a bummer they didn't get to see that out through. But I think, you know, a lesson for the program in terms of just making sure you come out fully ready, prepared, and avoid getting blitzed, you know, for when this comes around, hopefully next year for them.
Yep, totally agreed. And then the final team to talk about is the Wisconsin Badgers, who, you know, followed up a very impressive run to the Big Ten Conference tournament semi or Big Ten tournament finals by just dropping an absolute dud in their opening round game against James Madison. And you could tell from the first 5 to 7 minutes that I can't even really tell you what it was, but Wisconsin just did not look ready for the physicality and quickness of a James Madison team that we talked about was a good team, but you know, there was a pretty solid path forward to victory for Wisconsin, but that was immediately erased when they turned the ball over 7 times, I believe, in the first 10 minutes, resulting in only 5 points. And, you know, turned the ball over 19 times. That's more than a quarter of their possessions ended in turnovers. You know, they shot it okay from 3, 38% for the game, led by 5 from Max Klesmit, but, you know, we're terrible around the rim. I believe they missed 9 or 10 layups. They left 8 points at the free throw line. And this game just came down to the fact that they were not able to execute any part of their game plan. So despite the fact that they actually held James Madison under a point per possession and neither team shot the ball really efficiently, you know, Wisconsin just, it was one of those games where kind of like the game against Rutgers, where they just got out to a super slow start and couldn't make up ground quick enough. That was kind of how things happened for the Badgers on Friday night.
Yeah. I mean, you're probably not going to win many NCAA tournament games when you turn the ball over 19 times. Very uncharacteristic of the Badgers. But I mean, to me, the question going into this, and again, I'm not trying to oversimplify, but this was going to be about which Wisconsin team showed up. Was it, you know, the team that showed up the first half of the year that looked really good and sort of the team that reemerged for the conference tournament? Or was this going to be the team that we got from, you know, mid-January to mid-February? And it unfortunately was the latter. You know, I was a bit surprised that that was the case, given just how good of a week they had last week in Minneapolis for the Big Ten tournament. But, you know, we knew this was theoretically possible. I think this it stings a lot, you know, given that, like you said, you hold a 12 seed to 41% shooting from the field, and you know you should, you know, win that game. But James Madison sort of kept them at arm's length for most of the game. And you know, I think, like, look, good season overall for Wisconsin, right? Like, you know, rebounded from not making the tournament last year to, you know, get back to the tournament. I think there's a lot that you can hang your hat on, especially given sort of the fact that a lot of the roster came back and, you know, Storr was a great add by the transfer portal. But yeah, I feel like most people in Madison were hoping for not just one win in this tournament, but ideally 2 and a shot at Duke, but unfortunately didn't come.
Yeah, I think the inconsistency that this team showed is frustrating, but it was successful to get back into the tournament. There's still, you know, in theory, a lot of the roster should return next year. The fan base is not happy, but I think, you know, with how college basketball is working now, I think everyone might need to chill out a little bit. But yeah, it was not how anyone wanted to see this season end, and it was definitely an unfortunate set of circumstances that led to an early exit for Wisconsin. One more piece to get to before we talk about the Sweet 16 is actually a piece of coaching news. So now Michigan has hired Dusty May as their head coach, replacing Juwan Howard. And Steve, I think I'm going to let you have the floor with this one just to kind of get some initial thoughts from your end.
So, you know, Dusty May was kind of, I think nationally, you know, he was sort of the at the top of the list in like the up and comer category. And yeah, you know, I think in a way, like Dusty May was sort of, you know, a fantasy name for a lot of teams this year that, you know, were disappointed with the product that they were putting out. Even others in the conference, such as Indiana, you know, I think we're in Ohio State, even were super interested in Dusty May. But you know, at the end of the day, it sounded like, especially with, you know, those programs going in other directions and, you know, where the other openings were, it sounded like this came down to sort of Michigan and Louisville. And this was the guy that Michigan wanted. And so they went out and got him. You know, I think like, look, the Final Four pedigree, you know, from last year is what's alluring, but I don't know that, you know, this is by any means a slam dunk. And like, there are very few, I think, slam dunk hires that, you know, exist in college basketball these days, just with sort of the unknown of the transfer portal. And you know, Dusty May is going to have a tall task ahead of him, sort of rebuilding this program from the ground up. I think we know, you know, on this podcast, you know, what, you know, Michigan's capable of as a program, given their success in the last decade. You know, Dusty May is going to have his work cut out for him just in terms of putting together a roster for next year. But, you know, long term, I mean, you know, we're still in the gray area in terms of what does NIL look like in sort of the future here. And but I think at the flip side, you know, we've seen programs kind of turn things around, you know, fairly quickly. Nebraska took them a few years to get from the bottom, and you know, 4 years later they have things up and running solidly. So, you know, I think we'll just see in terms of whether this works out or not. But I think in terms of the up and comers you know, and the list that most teams, you know, had, Dusty May was at the top, and I think it's good for the conference that Michigan got him.
Yeah, I think it was a weird year to need a new coach. I think a lot of the more top end options were not really available. Obviously, there's still a lot that has to go down for the carousel to fully stop spinning, but things have settled down a little bit. So, and I think it's worth mentioning, you know, Dusty May took over a historically losing program in Florida Atlantic that had gone 12-19. The year before he was hired, and I do not believe they've had a losing season since. So it's a really, really, really incredible turnaround down in Boca Raton. I think it's also there's, like you said, there's no such thing as a slam dunk coaching hire, and I think fans have this overwhelming expectation of immediate success anytime change happens. So I think I would preach patience, because you know, he's definitely a program building guy based on his history, and you know, even though the portal has accelerated that to some degree, it still won't happen overnight. So, you know, I think he's going to need some time. He's proven to be a very good developer of players in terms of the guys that he brought back this year. I would say that I think this year was a little, you know, disappointing from a perspective of Florida Atlantic team that went to the Final Four last year. But, you know, I think there was also a surprisingly good job that he did the year before. So, they obviously, the Owls had a target on their back the entire season, and we kind of saw that in some of their games against potentially lesser competition. But they also beat Arizona this year and made it back to the tournament. So, you know, that's no small feat in a conference like the American. So I do think, you know, Michigan ended up with a guy that has a history of doing things the right way and you know, won't cause problems from that angle and has built a program before. So I think they're in – you know, they made a good hire, and I think we'll just have to wait to kind of see if that actually means anything. So that's the recap of the week that was. It was definitely a busy one, but this is March. And before we get into the Sweet 16 preview, I would just like to let everybody know that you can rediscover your ritual with Brewbag's Coffee Company and their single-serving flavored cold brew pouches. So whether you're looking for an easy way to make great cold brew, you're trying to save time in your busy morning, or you just want to have coffee your way while you're on the road, Brewbags are so easy, you can brew them in your sleep, and they're so delicious that you'll want to wake up. You can still enjoy free shipping and 10% off your first order at brewbagscoffee.com by using discount code LAUNCH10, that's LAUNCH10, to take 10% off your first order. Thank you again to Brewbags for sponsoring this podcast. All right, so Steve, we've made it. We are almost at the second weekend of the NCAA tournament. And this is where things get serious. So on Thursday we have Illinois versus Iowa State, and you know, we kind of joke about this stuff all the time, especially when a team like Iowa is involved, but this is truly unstoppable force meets immovable object. Illinois is the number one offense in the country per KenPom. Iowa State is the number one defense. So something is going to have to give. We know how Illinois works. We've talked about them enough. They want to run the ball. They want to get running off of missed shots. They really excel in transition, and they have some issues on the defensive end, but they've been able to, even in the half court, they've been able to be extremely effective on offense, you know, with whether that's with Domask in the post, whether that's getting dangerous in touches, whether that's Shannon coming off screens and hitting some pretty tough jumpers. They have a variety of options on offense, which is why I'm really excited for this matchup, because I'm really curious to see how Underwood goes against Otzelberger's extremely, extremely solid defense. You know, number one in the country, you know, they've held both of their NCAA tournament opponents under 1 point per possession. And they also are very good offensively, ranking in the top 50 in efficiency for offense. So they're an experienced team. They run two seniors and a junior out there in their starting lineup, with a very, very good freshman who's more of an offensive bucket getter in Milan Musilovic. So I'm just curious to see what you're looking for kind of in this game.
I'm thinking about two things as we're talking through this game. So one, and you kind of hit on this, but College Basketball Insiders sort of market Iowa State as like a elite defensive team. And I mean, you said it better than anyone, right? They're a number one ranked defensive team in the country. But I want to emphasize another point that you made. I mean, this team shoots 46% from the field. They're also a really, really good offensive team too. And feels stupid to just say it this way, but you need a good offense to keep winning in March, right? And so what I'm thinking about is, if this game turns into a shootout, you know, and Illinois is able to handle Iowa State's strong defense, can Iowa State keep punching? And yeah, I don't know. And frankly, if you're asking me to pick a team, just like conference biases aside, I want the team with the best player on it, you know, who also happens to be the best athlete, you know, and you could argue that offensively, Illinois has the two best players on their team in this game. And I think that might end up being what the difference is. Now, the other thing that I'm looking at is, look, I think athletically, Terrence Shannon has proven that there's no one in the Big Ten that can stop him, not as a team, not as an individual defender. But I genuinely believe that the Big 12 has been the best conference in all of basketball this year. And I think athletically, they, particularly on the defensive end, they have guys not just on Iowa State, but across the conference that make it incredibly difficult, you know, for you to move and score. And so to me, in a way, you know, I think the second half of this game is going to come down to Terrence Shannon's athletic ability and ability to score one-on-one versus those really good Iowa State individual defenders. And it's going to be, you know, the sheer force of who wins that matchup, which will determine who wins this game.
Yeah, I think that's a very important context. I think, you know, if I'm looking here at some of the advanced metrics, and you know, there's a chance Iowa State is not particularly an elite three-point shooting team, but they are in the top 100. And Illinois' three-point defense has been a bit suspect. So I think that's where Iowa State is going to have to kind of convert a bunch if they want to keep pace with how Illinois wants this game. It's also going to be a battle of tempos, right? Like, Iowa State's 206th in tempo, so they definitely are more deliberate and will work. They're very okay working through the half-court sets. And Illinois is a lot faster at 70th. So, and we know obviously they like pushing the ball. So I think it's also going to be who can control the style. So do we think that, and this is the hypothetical, I don't know that anyone has an answer because obviously we're not part of either of these teams' game plans, but I think if Iowa State kind of foregoes the offensive rebounding, which, you know, they're good at, but not necessarily great, to keep Illinois in from getting out in transition and working in the half court. And they can also keep Illinois off the boards because Illinois is the top 20 team in offensive rebounding. So they like to generate those second chance points. And I think especially if with Danger getting more run recently, you know, he's definitely going to be in there mixing it up and trying to get physical. So I think I lean Illinois just because I think their offense has a greater history of just doing enough to win this year, potentially at the expense of their defense. So I'm going to pick them to advance, but I'm curious to hear your thoughts.
I'm taking Illinois too.
All right. It is decided then. And then just the winner of this game will play San Diego State or UConn. And the Marcus will favor that team ends up playing UConn. UConn is going to be a horrible matchup for anybody. It's not a great matchup for Illinois, but again, if Illinois can control the pace of that game, I think that, and, you know, make just kind of keep clinging out of it and really attack the boards, I think that they have a shot to win that game. But they're going to need to really be dialed in on the defensive end because UConn has so many offensive threats that it doesn't matter if they're in the half court or out in transition.
Yeah, I think the difference between this Iowa State matchup and the UConn one is that I'm modestly confident that Iowa State is going to have its way with Illinois' defense, but I'm like 100% confident that UConn would have its way with Illinois' defense. And, you know, the just skill that they have, I do not think Illinois has enough to beat UConn with a trip to the Final Four online. But I think it just has due to the fact that they've got way better weapons than Iowa State does. So if you're asking me to predict, I will predict that, you know, Illinois gets one game this weekend, not two, and that UConn will be back in the Final Four for the second straight year.
Even though my bracket did have Illinois in the Final Four, it was not because they were beating UConn. So I am likely to agree with you on that statement. But even still, like an Elite Eight appearance would be huge for Illinois as a program. So you know, here's hoping that things go well. Then the last team to talk about is Purdue, who will be, I believe, in a rematch with Gonzaga. And it kind of is possible that their next three, it's very possible that Purdue's next three games mirror their run through Maui when they beat Gonzaga, then Tennessee, then Marquette. And that would be the lineup of that too. So obviously things were a lot different back on November 20th when Purdue and Gonzaga met. But I think, you know, it's interesting that we have this kind of data to go back. And it was a game where Purdue just really rode Zach Edey to the tune of 25 points, 14 rebounds, and he was really able to dominate this Gonzaga team that does not have the frontline size. You know, Graham Ike is a great player, but he's 6'9", 240, and Braden Huff is more of a stretch big at 6'10", 240. So, you know, both really, really good players. Gonzaga is coming off just an absolute demolishing of Kansas. So I think that there's a lot. Gonzaga's been playing really well. Believe they've lost one game since February 4th. So they're obviously playing as good as they have all season. Mark Few is one of the best coaches in college basketball. So I'm from a stylistic standpoint, I'm really interested to see schematically how Painter and Few go at it. We've got two top 10 offenses, so there should be a lot of points. And I think it's going to come down to if Gonzaga can throw Edey off his game and really make Smith, Lawyer, Jones be the ones taking the shots. Not that that's guaranteed to get a win, but because of how Edey was able to attack Gonzaga back in November, there's a blueprint to winning this game, and it would be through him.
So I do think that there is likely to be a one seed that goes down in the Sweet 16 this weekend. I do not think it'll be Purdue, though. This game's being played in Detroit, you know, so it will be, you know, a heavily Purdue crowd at this game. And like, look, I think Gonzaga's maybe, you could argue, a little bit more balanced offensively than Purdue is, but I also don't think they deserve a ton of credit for demolishing this Kansas team that has looked flimsy and soft all year. And we're without their best player. At the same time, like, it's the sixth straight Sweet 16 for Gonzaga. You know, we shouldn't have been surprised at that happening regardless. But what we know has eluded Gonzaga is, you know, a national championship slash getting farther than the Sweet 16 when kind of pushes come to shove around them. And I don't think this team, you know, there's no Jalen Suggs, right? Like, you know, showing up for Gonzaga. I think it's much more of a blue collar team. But Purdue is also a blue collar team. And I think they're going to blue collar them better just because that's what they've done all year. And they have, things have changed, but, you know, they've got a blueprint for how to beat them from how they beat them earlier in the year. And frankly, I like Purdue. I like Purdue in this game, and I like for Purdue to get all the way through because, you know, especially when you get to these teams out of conference. And, you know, I know if it's Tennessee, they will have seen them again. But, like, even thinking about Creighton, I mean, the advantage that I think Creighton has with, like, a Kalkbrenner, you know, is neutralized to some degree when you throw Edie out there. And so I like Purdue. I think they're peaking at the right time. They're on a mission. And I do not think that Gonzaga nor anyone else in this region has enough to hang with them.
Yeah. So Purdue is once again the top offensive or the top 3-point shooting team in the country per KenPom at just under 41% from three. Gonzaga is 171st in the country at 3-point defense. So, you know, I think with all the attention on Edie and how he was able to play well in their first meeting, I would assume that Gonzaga is just going to try and let him get as many points as he wants while holding off the three. This Gonzaga team can definitely score. So, you know, I think this is a game where we're going to see a lot of points. But, you know, I think Edie in the middle is going to be enough of a deterrent, and they won't be able to quite work their offense the way they'd like to through Huff and EK in the post. And their guards, I would say, you know, Nembhard and Hickman are good guards. I don't think they're, like you said, the caliber of a Jalen Suggs or some of the other elite guards they've had. So I do like Purdue in that game. And I think, you know, you talk about a Purdue-Tennessee matchup. I mean, Dalton Connect is the guy at Tennessee, and he does pose kind of an interesting matchup problem because he's too big for a guy like Lance Jones. But, you know, they're not going to put Kaufman Wren on him. So I think you kind of just similarly, you just kind of let Connect get his and beat them with the size and your other advantages. And I think against Creighton, because Kalkbrenner plays drop coverage so much, that pick and roll, like, Smith can just dice them up in the pick and roll and just hit the same mid-range jumpers he's hit all year. And that, you know, having the gravity of Edie, especially given how Creighton plays defense, it will be a really tough matchup. I mean, Creighton has a lot of offensive firepower too. You know, they're as you know, one of the top 12 teams in the country in offense, but they don't force a lot of turnovers and don't really speed teams up defensively the way you kind of need to. So that game will also be a lot of shot making. Ashworth and Shireman and Alexander all are elite offensive players, but I worry about how they're going to actively be able to defend against an Edie. So you have Purdue making it out of this region?
Yes, sir.
Same here. You know, here's hoping that we can get two Big Ten teams in the Final Four. We'll be talking about them in the preview section next week. But that's why they play the games. So that'll be it for us today. Thank you so much for sticking with us. You know, we again would appreciate 5-star review, likes on Spotify, however you get your podcast. Please say good things about us. Got any questions, comments, concerns? We're Big Ten Hoops Weekly at gmail.com. Thanks again, and we will see you next week.